Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. And we have our first caller on the air, and that is Pamela from San Diego. Hello, Pamela.
Okay, well, first of all, I've been listening to you for many years, but this is the first time I've called, and I want to thank you so much for all you've taught me over the years. I'm very glad that I figured out how to call in today. I've got a more pressing problem. I experienced my first UTI. I'm 70, so I've been lucky. So I didn't recognize it when it first happened, and then it got quite bad, and then my doctor finally figured out I should go to the doctor, and he did the culture, but before the culture came back, he put me on cephalexin, and the culture came back as being Pseudomonas aeruginosa. He then put me on, and it cultured finally. I got the word that the antibiotic ceprofloxacin was the one I should be taking. And the first one didn't work at all. Second one did work very well. However, after taking three pills, I got this ringing in my ear, tinnitus. So I called up much back and forth, and I ended up continuing to take the medication, even though there's a possibility it's doing damage to my ears, because it seems that this is such a nasty bug. So I went ahead, and the original prescription was for 3 or for 5 days. So now I decided to take it for 3 days, because the pharmacist told me that that's kind of might work. I'm now just finishing my third day. And I also remember on one of my old, the shows I've listened to, I remember you talking about maybe probiotics when there are biofilms involved and so forth, which is apparently what this is. So anyway, I would really appreciate any advice you can give me on how to proceed, whether to sort of continue with this antibiotic in spite of the ringing in my ears or...
I think you need to stop the antibiotic and find a substitute, because the ringing in the ears, this is a known antibiotic a known antibiotic side effect. Are you taking any aspirin products or anything like that? Okay. So given when it started and its conjunction, and tinnitus is a ear toxicity and a neurotoxicity symptom, and Cipro has some interesting properties. It's Cipro, right, that we are taking?
One
of the properties is weakening the tendons, but it also has rarely been associated as a neurotoxin, and many other antibiotics like gentamicin and tobramycin are much, much worse. And in fact, we really worry about ototoxicity. We monitor blood levels of those agents. Are you a small person by any chance? Low body weight?
I'm medium. I'm 134 pounds,
okay.
And I'm 5'5".
Okay, so medium average size person. So that makes it less likely that you would be having an issue with the an issue, but not that much less likely. So when we get an idiosyncratic response to a drug, we need to respect that. And with ear toxicity, we worry that it may not go away, that this could be a permanent thing. So definitely you're better off with a bladder infection than you are with this. Now, Pseudomonas is a nasty bug. That's true. And part of the reason it's nasty is that it develops resistance to a lot of antibiotics. You said that your Pseudomonas was sensitive to Cipro. Was it sensitive to any other agents, or do you know that?
Well, they told me that there was one more, but that one even had more side effects.
Well, not in your case, because you've got a big one, And so statistically, that may be true. And I'm not sure what, I don't have the sensitivities here. But as a general principle, we're going to talk about natural stuff that you can do as well. It is, but urinary tract infections come from gut flora, from basically colonic bugs that are getting trapped somehow in or are getting into the urethra, either because you wipe from back to front or because you had diarrhea and a little bit splashed up into your urea from the toilet, or you rode a horse, you know, all sorts of things can let that stuff travel. Intercourse being, of course, the classic one, but there's lots of ways for it to get up there. And when you grow Pseudomonas in the bladder, it's no more dangerous than any other bacteria. It's very dangerous in the lungs. It's not, but it isn't, and it is a drug that likes to get resistant. So we don't want to change antibiotics, and we don't want to stop antibiotics early, but we can shift antibiotics to the other thing it's sensitive to. And so I really do think that would be your best advice in terms of how to do that, is just to call them tomorrow. And in the short run, I wouldn't take any more doses. Cipro lasts, it has a, you know, it's supposed to be a twice a day drug. It has a quote unquote half-life of 12 hours, but it will stay in the system for a while longer and you'll be able to use it. You know, your bloodstream will be able to keep the bacteria at bay. So if you call in the morning, you should be able to get switched to something, make a point of getting on it right away. In the meantime, also very good for bladder infections because of this biofilm concept. There are two things. My favorite is a compound called D-mannose. Large D, it stands for dextro, hyphen, man, like, you know, mankind. Man and then nose. So man's nose, but just mannose. And this stuff coats the inside of your bladder. This in combination with cranberry juice. I like to use the unsweetened, but if you can't stand it, you can take a little bit of the sweetened kind and dilute it, because that stuff is just full of sugar, added sugar, because they want to make it taste like soda pop. But cranberry juice is really good. I like that. I like the cranberries. If you can figure out a way to eat cranberries, that would work.
I do, actually.
Okay. So, but cranberries contain a compound, as do blueberries, that also help coat the pili of the bacteria. The pili are the little grappling hooks that allow the bacteria to stick. So essentially, you're going after the bacteria's ability to, you know, they divide, but they don't get to stay in there. And so it tends to help you clear the infection. Lots and lots of fluid so that you're peeing a lot will help keep the symptoms down. And hopefully you'll be able to get onto another antibiotic and get this cleared up. Now, once you've got it dead, it's not over, because you actually have to restore your gut flora, and you may have a dysbiosis going. It's a really good idea to, do you like yogurt? Can you eat yogurt, and can you eat sauerkraut? I won't even bother to ask you if you like them. If you can
I like them both.
Good.
Actually.
So 8 ounces of each daily, and that will provide you about 20 billion thereabouts organisms, plus some food for those organisms to eat, particularly the sauerkraut, because it has residual carbohydrates that can be that the bacteria can continue to ferment. Other good sources of fermentable food for your bacteria that you're trying to reestablish in the aftermath of the forest fire that you created with the Cipro and with the whatever else you take. The other strategy that you want to look at is using apples and root vegetables. So an apple a day, believe it or not.
Oh, okay.
And that's easy. And then a different root vegetable. So, you know, go out and get a rutabaga, go out and get a turnip, you know, roast them. They're actually, if you roast them in the oven, they're actually delicious and you won't have a problem with them. And they have a great source of probiotic spores as well. So they've got seeds of a different bacteria, and you want to change your root vegetables because a different one each day gives you a broader variety of bacteria. Everybody's different. And while I use the commercial probiotics in my practice, this is a more natural way to go about it. And just based on your question, it seems like that's how you would prefer to go.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, well, that is very informative. I have a question about a theory. When I was reading about this bug, it talked about it being in hot tubs and swimming pools, and that's a real successful vector for that to because I'm trying to figure out how I managed to get this thing. And then I remembered that I have a bidet toilet seat sort of washlet. It's like a little Toto thing that is heated. And about a couple of months ago, I got a charcoal whole house water filter that takes the chlorine out. And I was wondering if keeping that heated water in that toilet seat thing, and then, you know, for spraying right where you wouldn't want a bug to be, if that could possibly be where.
I'm sorry, run that by me again. I kind of lost that. You were spraying what?
Okay. So think bidet.
Right.
A bidet. But Toto makes a toilet seat.
Yes.
That is a bidet.
Oh, right, right, right. I've seen those. Yeah.
I love, you know, it's great.
However, that is just possible.
I did a little research online, and it said they actually did find in hospitals with those bidet things, they did find Pseudomonas.
Pseudomonas loves water. We find it in ventilator tubing, oxygen tubing. That's why it's such a strong hospital organism.
And of course, I just took out the chlorine, so it would make it even more.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the charcoal actually is a nest. It's like a coral reef for bacteria. It's a bio, and the bacteria will lay down biofilm on the charcoal and live in the biofilm.
Oh, no.
So I think you need to walk that one back. There's probably, and it could very well be that this was coming from Pseudomonas that literally just splashed from your poop onto the toilet seat, managed to get into the tubing, and is quite happy with living in the residual water there. You could try culturing it, but
I would love to do that. I don't know how to, because I love my Toto washlet thing.
Yeah, I understand. Well, I think the water's coming from the pipe, and where did the chlorine come in on this?
Well, the chlorine supposedly comes out from the big charcoal filter thing that I just had installed to the tune of several thousand dollars outside the house.
Mm. You know, okay.
It takes the chlorine out of all the water in the house.
I got it. Okay. So, yeah. So that might make things easier for the... You know what I would do? This is getting outside of my field of expertise.
Okay.
But I would contact the manufacturer. And ask them if there's any way to, if it got contaminated, how would I clean it? And, you know, they may go, oh, well, let us send you another unit or something like that. They might just send you another unit because I don't know if they are cleanable. And it's amazing. You invent a new device and it works, but it also, there's always some kind of unintended consequence, isn't there, with the new inventions?
Absolutely.
Some of them good. Not this one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. What a fascinating, urinary tract infection sounded like it was going to be boring, but it actually opened up a lot of doors. So thank you very much. And please keep listening, Pamela in San Diego.
Oh, I will for sure. I always listen to your podcast. Okay.
All right. Well, bye for now.
Thanks again.
Bye. My lead story, based on the program that was on earlier, I had pulled this, but I decided to jump it to the front. How playing drums changes the brain, because many years of playing the drum actually leave clear traces on MRI. People who play the drums regularly for years differ in their brain structure and also in their functions. So this was coming from Ruhr University Bochum, which sounds like it's in Germany. I'm not actually sure. And these researchers in Ruhr Universität Bochum were looking with MRI at the brains of subjects who are long-term drum players, at least 17 years, and who practice their drums at least 10 hours a week, and comparing them to 25 people who have not got any particular musical talent at all or musical experience. So let's see, there were 20 professional drummers and 24 controls. They used a bunch of different MRI techniques. First, they had the groups play drums, and then they were placed in the MRI scanner. And what they saw was that the drummers had very clear differences physically in the front part of their corpus callosum. This is the brain structure that connects the right and left hemisphere, and the front part of that is motor planning. The drummers had fewer fibers, but they were much thicker. So bigger cabling, fewer cables. This really speeds up the ability to exchange information. And you would only bother to grow thicker cables if there was a lot of practice and a lot of demand. So here we have actual physical, we're starting to be physically able to see what's going on in the brain. And I have a couple of other stories about that as well. Also, the thickness of the corpus callosum actually predicted the performance in a drum test. So the higher the measure of the thickness, the better the drumming performance by, I'm not quite sure what objective measurement. And the brain of the drummers during drumming was actually less active than that of the control subjects. There's a term for this. It's called sparse sampling. Basically, the brain is more efficiently organized, so there's less activation. The old, yes, you can do, after enough practice, you can do it in your sleep, might actually be true. And the next story is also about brain rhythms, brains and rhythms, a little bit different. This is gamma rhythms. Now, a gamma pulse is a brain wave that is going at 40 hertz, so that's relatively slow. And for the last couple of years, we've in neuroscience been very fascinated by the fact that the gamma rhythms seem to improve memory performance. They seem to help with cognition. And this is not just like a temporarily entrainment thing. There's actually structural change. Of course, most of that work's been done in mice. There were three papers published this year in a journal called Cell and Neuron, and they've shown that if you expose mice to light flickering or sound buzzing at 40 hertz, this is called, they're calling it gamma entrainment using sensory stimuli. I'm going to abbreviate that, gamma entrainment. It strengthens the rhythm across the brain, and you see improvement in spatial functioning in mice that are wearing little gamma helmets or listening to gamma or having gamma flashed in their little mouse cage maze. But also, you're seeing changes in gene expression, changes in the activity of multiple different brain cell types, not just neurons, but also glial cells and astrocytes. If you measure amyloid protein and tau protein, which are the things that build up in Alzheimer's mice, the levels drop. Turns out the astrocytes get woken up by the gamma rhythm and start chowing down and degrading those toxic proteins. So the gamma could, in fact, be a therapy, not just an interesting esoteric science fact, but something that you could actually do for people with Alzheimer's. And I would say reasonably harmlessly, if you are feeling like you're starting to have some cognitive issues, or particularly if you have a family history or an APOE4 gene that you know about, it might be worth figuring a way to get something, get a light flickering or generate a sound that's buzzing at 40 hertz and just keep it in the background, particularly while you sleep, because that's when the detoxification, that's when those astrocytes, you want those fully engaged and hungry, going out there and eating those toxic proteins. Now, that's a leap. There aren't a lot of data in humans, but I like it because, and I bet you there'll be a Kickstarter if there isn't already, or a GoFundMe on this, because it just makes sense to develop a gamma stimulator headphone that just plays a gamma buzz in the background. It's very fascinating. The microglia, which are the support cells, change their gene expression. They actually physically change their shape, and they reduce the inflammatory response, all things that would be good in an Alzheimer's model. And as I mentioned, the astrocytes get more reactive, and that causes them to consume those pathological proteins. We do see that the gamma does cause changes in the cells of the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex, and that's memory and cognition, respectively. So we are just on the ground floor of a fascinating palace of memory here, and I'm extremely excited to see what comes out of this work in Alzheimer's mice. Normally, I'm not particularly interested in drug work that comes out for Alzheimer's, but this is that's largely because these mice have been genetically manipulated to accumulate beta amyloid, and that doesn't seem to be the problem with most cases of human Alzheimer's. It's not that they accumulate it so abnormally, it's that they have inflammation that causes them to make more of it. So we got to make less of it by reducing inflammation, and it seems like this gamma may do exactly that. So that's pretty cool. So while we're on the brain, one more story. This one about further progress in deep brain stimulation. Deep brain stimulation is currently FDA approved for two things, Parkinson's disease and functional tremor. And some people get such bad tremor that they literally can't feed themselves. There is a surgery that's done for that where a stimulator is implanted in the brain. So there's a battery pack right under the arm, kind of like a pacemaker that we might use. And then they go up the vagus nerve and down deep into the brain, very invasive, very dangerous. But if a person is completely disabled or close to it, it seems like a reasonable thing to do. Deep brain stimulation has been, I wouldn't say it's been a non-starter in Parkinson's, but it's been frustrating because while it's very effective for benign essential tremor, it works about 40 to 50% of the time in Parkinson's, and no one's really been able to figure that out. And in some of the people who had the surgery, it's really messed with their memory changes, and caused mood changes. Some of them have had the side effects without any improvement. A study that just came out from the Washington University School of Medicine at St. Louis may point the way towards improving the treatment. Typically, the stimulators are implanted in structures known as the thalamus and the basal ganglia, which are deep in the brain. And these researchers found, looking at MRI maps that I'll come to in just a moment, that there are hubs like freeway interchanges where the neurological networks control movement, vision, and other brain functions. And where those neurons cross the freeway interchange, they cross paths, they exchange information. Well, that's all very well and good. That's how the brain is organized. But here's the information that's new. Different people have a different map. And so the location of their interchanges is sufficiently different that we can't rely on the way we've normally been doing this, which is to look at stroke. Person has a stroke or an injury, and then we look at what have they got going on, what happened to them, and we say, oh, well, maybe if we stimulate that area, we can help people who have this sort of a problem. And they've really been working on this. They've got the technology. And so the researchers, including Nico Dosenbach, who is the head professor in charge of this, set out to create individual maps of functional networks in the basal ganglia and the thalamus. They used data from a group. I love scientists. They're always experimenting on themselves. They did a group of Washington University scientists basically had access to an MRI. So they scanned themselves at night. They called themselves the Midnight Scan Club. And so they had 10 hours of brain scan data from each of 10 individuals. And so they had essentially sample networks. So they created 3D color-coded maps by functional network, one for vision, two for movement, two for paying attention, three to goal-related behaviors, and the last to the default network, which is what happens when you're just chilling and not doing any mental tasks. So what they found was one location they called the motor integration zone that was pretty much in the same place for all 10 people. That, by the way, after they showed it to a neurosurgeon, he said, oh, well, that's exactly where we put the electrodes for essential tremor, and that works about 99% of the time. But when they looked at Parkinson's, they saw that there was a great deal of variation about where the motor centers that you would use for Parkinson's were located. And so now what we understand about brain stimulation is that we need to scan each individual and give that individual a mapping. That's going to add to the cost of brain stimulation, but it is going to greatly add to the success of brain stimulation. So I guess what we need to do is get the price of MRIs down, because this is going to have to be a prerequisite for deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease, unless we just want to flip a coin. And personally, when you're talking about putting a wire in my brain and turning me into the terminal man, old Michael Crichton story for those of you who that went past, good book, worth reading. And let's go now to our caller, and that is Christopher in Santa Cruz. Hello, Christopher.
Hi, yes. Hi, Dr. Don. This is Christopher Smith. I'm the host of Classical Tune-Up.
Oh, hi.
On Sunday mornings. Yeah, but listening to your show, my wife and I have always enjoyed you for years. You'd know us if you saw us. It's been a few years, though. So my question, just very quickly here. First of all, Michael Crichton, yes, Terminal Man. Great. Absolutely. I know what you're talking about there. But you were talking about drumming, right, and drummers. And I grew up, I was kind of being trained as a drummer when I was younger. I took some lessons and so forth. But in the end, I became a pianist. I studied classical piano. So I'm wondering if you think that study about drummers might apply to, say, pianists.
Oh, yeah, because you're playing two different tunes, you know, two different things with both hands. I mean, how long did it take you to get to the point where you could do that? Think back.
Well, it's hard to think, you know, when you think of when you started playing, but, you know, probably not too long, maybe, you know, but I practiced a lot, all that hard repertoire, you know, Chopin,
mm-hmm.
Beethoven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the hand movements are different, and you're moving them in different times. So I think that it's probably very similar. There would be, in my opinion, I would anticipate that the part of the brain, the fine motor circuitry, would mm-hmm. perhaps be more developed. And with drumming, it might be the whole corpus callosum, but you might see a bigger piece across the cabling that goes to the hand from that area. Uh-huh. You know, they're just looking at the corpus callosum, but when we can do fine mapping and look at the thinner nerves rather than this big thing, which is like two thumbs across. I mean, this is a large structure in the brain. But when we get to the point where we can look at the fine structure, I bet we're going to have all kinds of predictive value, not just in terms of brain diseases, but also in terms of brain capacities. So, yes, I think it's absolutely going to be the case.
Well, good. You know, my wife often jokes, you know, because I'm, you know, well into my 50s, pushing 60, all that good stuff, but I often sit there and say, well, you know, I was classically trained, I performed, I did chamber music, you know, with the musicians, still do when I can, but I always say to her, this is my therapy, this is my way to keep my brain sharp as I get older, you know, I figure it's a way to, you know, keep other maladies, mental maladies at bay. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but I hope so.
I think it probably is. Learning a new instrument is probably going to be more useful for you, or better yet, go outside of your comfort zone as much as possible. Maybe pick up a new language. But musical instrument and new language, something that's different. So let's see, you are a pianist. wind instrument would be a sort of medium thing, totally different set of brain cells, but you'd be better off working on Spanish if you don't speak Spanish, or some other, whatever fascinates you.
Sure. My wife's German, so I studied German for several years and can hack it a little bit, but yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so start listening to German, German podcasts. There's all sorts of language learning things out there now that are very inexpensive. You just have to sit through the ads, which unfortunately are not in the language you're trying to learn. But movies, obviously there's plenty of movies. Turn off the subtitles and really work your skills, particularly output. Because when you do output, that is to say, when you speak the language or have a conversation, your brain just lights up because you're thinking about what you're going to say, and then you're thinking about how am I going to say that, and then you're thinking about how you're going to make your tongue and mouth and lips form the shapes in order to make the sound, and then you're hearing the sound and you're reflecting back to decide, well, did I get the sound right? And so all of that sort of stuff bouncing up around the brain creates the stimulation for new neurons. And then the other thing to do is weightlifting, which is by far the best way to consolidate those new neurons that your brain is trying to form.
Well, thank God I go to the gym a couple times a week as well. So we're good. It seems like
you're pretty much on the right track. You're doing all the right things,
right.
Well, including helping out your community and donating your time here to K-Squid.
Sure thing. And we'll give the plug, listen to Classical Tune-Up Sundays, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. and obviously on our podcast. So thanks a lot, Doctor. And have a great evening.
I like Telemann Brass. So for morning. So
Telemann. Okay.
Just to mention.
There's a request from Dr. Don. Telemann. I will do that.
All right. Thank you, Christopher. Bye bye. Let's go to, first of all, real quickly to Dan in Baltimore. Dan writes, love your podcast. Listen to it regularly. I am unfortunately a long-term omeprazole user, 20 plus years daily, and would like to wean myself off this drug using your recommended protocol. Unfortunately, it's now nearly impossible to buy Zantac. The local stores have all pulled it off the shelves due to the latest carcinogen scare. And we covered that about a month ago. And yeah, it's a thing. And it's a toxic compound that has been identified in some batches of Zantac, and I think there's been a bit of an overreaction, but hey, that's what happens. You can use Tagamet, which is also available over the counter, and your dose would be 200 to 400 milligrams. So you want to do twice, let's see, the over-the-counter dose of Zantac is 75, so you'd want to do 400 of Tagamet and follow the protocol. By the way, for those of you who are going, what's she talking about? And what's he talking about? On my website, askdrdon.com, there is a resources section. And I've posted, notes that handouts that I give to patients, articles, references, things I think will be useful for you. It's a bit of a hodgepodge. Maybe I should say it's a field full of Easter eggs where you can discover something really cool. Anyway, feel free to go there and look at the protocol that I evolved called getting off of proton pump inhibitors, something everyone should try to do with all of the strategies. And it's a clinically derived protocol, not big data at all, small data and clinical experience. I was just talking to some doctors the other night about big data medicine versus small data medicine. And, a whole bunch of data across a large cross-section of the population versus years and years of iterative learning. Talk to a woodworker and ask him how do you get a master craftsman, and it's not through big data. Onward. Diana in Monterey asks, dear Dr. Don, how often do you hear complaints about accelerating neck muscle stiffness associated with aging? And what are the most common causes? Well, Diana, let's read your second half of the questions again, and then we'll get back to your answers. How do you feel about shiatsu back and neck massage? I feel very good about shiatsu back and neck massage. Heat cushions as a treatment. Not sure what cushions as a treatment would be, but nice, moist heat can penetrate deeply and definitely help relax muscles. What about elastic back braces designed to pull your shoulders back and to straighten posture? Dr. Don is very down on back braces in general, low back braces, upper back braces. I know I've been seeing that ad too on the internet when I'm looking at looking stuff up. And the problem with that is that you're not really getting to the root of the problem, which is weak back muscles. We were talking to Christopher earlier about weightlifting. Resistance exercise where you row, where you basically put your arms out in front of you at about nipple height and then bring them back, rubbing your forearms and your elbow across your ribs as you do so. Try to get your elbows to kiss and do that with some resistance, maybe a bungee cord, maybe a rubber band. You want to be careful where you put the rubber band so that you don't end up with a Darwin Award. Make sure that it's attached to something that's secure, that's not going to let go and slam into your chest. But this is a really good way to build up those back muscles. And then the part two of that is to stretch the chest muscles. Everybody should be doing this because we're not dangling from trees. We're not stretching out our pecs the way that humankind used to. And as a result, we're all turning into sort of hunched over chimpanzees. And that is just like that lovely leaning cypress down in Monterey County. If the wind is always blowing in the same direction, the tree is going to grow that way while your body basically fixes in the direction that you're leaning. So wall stretches, taking breaks, pulling back, making sure your head's in a neutral position. You can look, there's a computer ergonomics thing in the resources at AskDrDon.com too that kind of shows you how to set up your terminal to avoid hurting yourself. But frequent breaks is also key. Now, you asked, what are the what causes accelerating neck muscle stiffness? And it kind of depends on where there's stiffness. If the stiffness is on the upper neck, and I kind of consider the upper neck to be, if you can put your index finger in your ear and you can touch the pain with your thumb, then that's upper neck. And when you get lower than that, then that's lower neck, and it's a different set of causes. The multifides, which are muscles that are found in the spine that kind of hold the vertebrae together, they're very deep. They'll often, those are the ones where when you turn your head rapidly and you get a sharp twinge, that's a spasm of the multifides. So those are muscles that are very hard to get to by massage. They respond really well to stretching. So in upper neck, injury to those, and facet arthritis. Facet arthritis means that the pads where the bones hook together have become arthritic, and that is definitely an age-related change that's very common. What we like to do in the case of arthritis is anti-inflammatory therapy, and there are natural anti-inflammatories such as high doses of fish oil, a high doses of curcumin. Some people do very well with sour cherry. That doesn't work for everybody. And there are a number of other good anti-inflammatories out there like cat's claw that I will sometimes use. You want to get to an anti-inflammatory diet and see if that makes a difference. And what does that mean? Well, wait until January because you're not going to want to try to do this between now and New Year's. It means low sugar and low starch. Very minimal to no bread. If you're really brave, come off gluten. But you also have to come off high doses of rice, high doses of any kind of carbohydrate, except vegetables that are like green vegetables or root vegetables. These things don't have a high glycemic index. And what we're trying to do is lower your insulin. Insulin is a potent driver for inflammation. And after a couple of weeks, if your aches and pains get better, that's a huge win. Another source of inflammation, very common in older people, very common in the winter, low vitamin D. We don't absorb vitamin D as well. We don't get out as much. And of course, we have a culture that's mainly indoors in the winter, and the sun is too weak to give us any vitamin D in our skin anyway. Even if we went out and lay on the beach all day, we wouldn't get any vitamin D. So taking vitamin D supplements for people who have a flare of their of what seems like arthritis, very beneficial. So how do you tell the difference between muscles and arthritis? A lot of times you can do it by simply passive movement. If a person has arthritis, when they move the joint passively, it'll still hurt. In other words, you're not using your own muscles to move it. You're using your other hand, or someone else is moving it for you. It may not hurt as quickly, but it will still hurt. If the problem is muscular or tendon or ligament, it usually, well, ligament's a different story, but muscles and tendons, when the movement is passive, don't hurt until you get to the very end of the movement where you're starting to stretch things, and then it'll start to hurt. But when you try to do it yourself, it'll hurt at a much lower axis of motion. So those are some of my over-the-telephone strategies for sorting out what's wrong with a patient. But as I said, stretching and movement, anti-inflammatories, these are just core to managing these problems. And we have one more email. It was a great day for emails. This from Rebecca in Cupertino. Health impact of hair removal treatments. Are there any long-term health concerns with different forms of long-term hair removal, such as various laser or pulse light treatments? I see advertisements for both in-center treatments and handheld devices that can be purchased for home use. Would there be any reason to avoid hair removal with laser or pulse lights in a specific body area, or applying these therapies to more than one body region? Thank you for making my Wednesday evenings enjoyable. Well, thank you, Rebecca, for your email. And it's a very good question. I think one that we want to spend a little bit of time on. First of all, lasers are a coherent light. That is to mean it is one wavelength, and it is amplified basically through a game of mirrors so that the wavelength becomes very, very strong. And this means that there is a higher potential for complications. The way that this works is that light is energy. And when the energy hits something that is a pigment, the pigment is going to absorb some of that energy, and it's going to vibrate. And as it vibrates, it's going to create heat. So you can use a laser, for example, to target oxyhemoglobin in the blood, which is a pigment, and you can make it vibrate and heat up, and you can cause the blood to literally boil in small little blood vessels and burn out a broken vein that way. This is used when people have hemangiomas. Hemangiomas are a type of birthmark where the blood vessels, there's excessive numbers of blood vessels. Gorbachev had one on his forehead, strawberry birthmarks, and there are other types of hemangiomas. But you can burn them shut effectively using a laser. This makes lasers very targeted and very strong, but also less useful for a variety of uses. Intense pulsed light is a different thing. It's visible light, so it's happening in this visible spectrum, roughly 400 to 1200 nanometers. And you can use a filter and apply it to different purposes. So people use pulse light, for example, to treat age spots, and they use pulse light for a number of other purposes, including hair removal, your question. So the first thing is eye protection is important, particularly if you're using lasers. And the intense pulse light treatments are effective, but they're not 100% effective. So there are some caveats. For one thing, there needs to be a high contrast between the skin tone and the hair. So it's best for fair-skinned, dark-haired people. If you're a blonde, and the hair that you're seeking to remove is light, you're not going to have as good a result. The results, hair count reduced about 60% at 12 weeks after multiple treatments. If you're doing IPL in a center, you're probably looking at 8 to 10 treatments to remove most of the visible hair. Results over time are good. The people who got to 60% at 12 weeks were still at 60% at 2 years. but it's rare that that there is total hair removal. I don't think there's any part of the body, and I would include the genitalia, that couldn't respond to this, but that would also, again, back to the color differential, the closer the color of the pubic hair to the color of the skin, the more thermal energy you're going to have to generate to get anywhere, the greater chance of a burn. The big thing is the retina. You don't want to be looking at these lights. If they use a filter, or they say use UV shades, by all means, use the ultraviolet lenses or filters. Don't be foolish about endangering your eyesight. And that is probably the biggest caveat with this form of hair removal. I wanted to talk about hypothyroidism. This was an email from a few weeks ago from Maggie in Santa Cruz. Dear Dr. Naughton, can you address the subject regarding treatment of hypothyroid and what you have observed with the use of levothyroxine or medications like Nature Thyroid that have T3 as well as T4, and what would you recommend? Well, first of all, I wanted to see if I can locate an article that was recently published in a Journal of the American Medical Association. Actually, it was written literally 2 days after Maggie sent this email, or at least the issue came out 2 days later, so it was on my mind. This was a study where they were saying, you know, we can't use one-size-fits-all reference ranges for hypothyroidism, and particularly in people over 80. We should not use the reference range for younger people. We shouldn't be trying to treat people who are 80 years old and have a TSH of 6 as long as they're fine. 6 to 7, if they don't have obvious symptoms of hypothyroidism, like feeling cold all the time, constipation, really low energy, that's probably normal for being 80. And so we need to look at the symptoms and treat the actual patient rather than treating the lab test. This, by the way, is a clinical principle. Remember earlier I was talking about big data versus deep data? Well, the deep data of long-term clinical experiences teaches you, don't treat the number, treat the patient, because there's a lot of individual variability. What the big data does is it allows you to average all that variability and come up with an algorithm and reference ranges that are going to work most of the time and, unfortunately, backfire some of the time. What we'd like to do is look at the actual patient in front of us and see whether we need to treat their number. So let's suppose that we have a TSH that we've decided that we want to treat. In that case, the first question you ask, that I ask myself, is about, do I think this person has normal adrenal glands and has a healthy lifestyle and adequate sleep and isn't in a very stressful situation with respect to their family or their own illnesses and their job and everything else? So if I've got a person who seems to be doing pretty well and just has low thyroid, I'll probably give them levothyroxine, which is the synthetic form, because their insurance will cover it without a murmur. And I will monitor to make sure that they convert it properly. But I don't have a reason to expect that they aren't going to convert it properly. On the other hand, if I have a patient who's very stressed out, let's say they have a special needs child and they're working, their husband's working, and so they're stretched very thin, maybe they got a couple of other kids or other symptoms or findings like anxiety that make me think that they're not sleeping well, that they might have some adrenal dysregulation. They wake up at 2 in the morning, 2, 3 in the morning, can't get back to sleep, mind's racing. That's a person I'm not going to probably start off with levothyroxine. That's an adrenal dysregulation symptom. Dizzy when you get up, feeling woozy all the time. Those are symptoms that at least make me think about going with a natural thyroid. And what's the difference? Well, levothyroxine is just the 4-iodine version of thyroid. That's the storage form. 90% of what your thyroid puts out is storage form. It floats around in your bloodstream and it's used as needed. It's like having canned soup. When you're hungry, you open the can. it's not active. In the case of T3, that's 10% of what the thyroid puts out. It's about 20% of what's in natural thyroid. And that is immediately available to stimulate. So it's the difference between an espresso and a can of coffee. So you have to prepare the can of the coffee in the can, but the espresso is right there. All you have to do is chug it and zing. So T3 is espresso and T4 is canned coffee. And if you have adrenal dysregulation, you're not going to be good. Your espresso machine is not going to be working very well, and you're not going to make T3, which we can measure. And so that's what I do. When I put someone on either of these agents, I monitor their T3. I look at it. I make sure that they're making enough. One of the keys is you can be in the normal range. You can, but if you're in the low normal of T3 and the high normal T4, you'll have a normal TSH, but you'll actually be in trouble. In my clinical experience, people vary a lot in how T3 affects their TSH. So you can't consistently give people tons of T3 and know what you're getting. And you can, you definitely want to work with a practitioner who knows what they're doing and starts you low and works you up gradually. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.